Hello?
Blog Talk Radio.
Oh.
Welcome to Dr. Guy's Monday Night Gumbo with your host, Dr. Tanisha Guy, licensed professional counselor, and co-host Andrea Wise Brown, life strategist and licensed professional counselor, and Sean the Realist. Dr. Guy Monday Night Gumbo and associates take no responsibility for the opinions or statements made by talk show hosts or their guests. Statements or show topics are not necessarily the beliefs of the show host. Dr. Guy Monday Night Gumbo is not intended to be therapy, but the sole purpose is to disseminate information, increase dialogue across ages, religious preference, gender, and sexual orientation. Don't forget to tune in every week to Dr. Guy's Monday Night Gumbo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another show of Dr. Guy's Monday Night Gumbo. So, welcome back from Resurrection Sunday. Hopefully, all of you guys had a really good weekend, and for some of you, you were able to enjoy a three-day weekend with Good Friday off. So, tonight, before we get into our show topic, I would like to introduce our guest, because we do have a guest sitting in with us tonight. Her name is Christia Rogers. And she's a licensed professional counselor supervisor, a national certified counselor, and a national certified trainer. She's also the owner of Bridges to Crossroads Counseling, and she'll be our guest sitting in with us tonight. Hi, Mrs. Rogers.
Hello, 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 ladies and gentlemen.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And as always, I want to introduce my co-host. You guys know him so well, Sean the Realist.
Hello, how's everybody doing tonight? I can't wait to get on this one.
As always, I never know what you're going to say. So we're going to go ahead and jump right into the topic for this evening. So our title tonight is What is Real Crazy Part 2. Now, for those of you who have been listening to the show for a couple years, you know that we did this show, I don't know, about 3 or 4 years ago. And so we're bringing it back to discuss some of the issues that we started off talking about. So tonight we really want to look at mental health issues in particular in the African-American community and the stigma that's attached to it. So I know that this is a touchy subject for a lot of people. A lot of people don't want to talk about it. It's kind of one of those things that you sweep in the closet and you act like it doesn't exist, or the person in your family who has the mental disorders, you act like they don't exist. So tonight we really want to talk about a few things. One, we want to look at why is there a stigma attached to mental health issues? Secondly, we're going to kind of explore some of the diagnoses that are more prevalent, in particular in the African-American community. And then lastly, we want to talk about what do we do to combat the stigma against mental health. So we're going to go ahead and jump right into it. And so Mrs. Rogers or Sean, whichever one of you guys want to go first, why do you guys think that there's a stigma attached to just mental health issues, period, in general?
Well, growing up black, I'm just going to jump out there and say that, I grew up in a very conservative household. And our kind of a theme that we had across our family was we're just going to pray about it, take it mm-hmm. to church and, you know, put it all on the altar. And, you know, if I had questions or concerns, it was like, oh, honey, we're going to keep our business, you know, in the house. We all grew up with knowing our counselor, but, you know, and if we had problems, you didn't talk about that outside of the home. You would get threatened, you know, that's our business. We're not going to talk about it. Suck it up, you know. You can cry on the inside, but smile on the outside. That was kind mm-hmm. of the way I grew up. And so carrying that with me so long, I didn't even know what to do with the information, you know, of, okay, I'm feeling this kind of way. Who do I talk to? Well, mm-hmm. I can talk to God. I believe in that strong, wholeheartedly. But sometimes you need somebody to really talk back to you, you know, with a sense of physical words to me. So I didn't know that until I became an adult to, you know, reach out and talk to a therapist and a counselor. And it was very helpful. And here I found myself on the other side of the seat and in the couch helping others.
I'm glad you brought that up pretty early, because that definitely seems to be one of the common themes that I hear in the African-American community when it comes to mental health issues is, I don't need a counselor. I go to church. I pray. And so I'm so glad that you addressed that, because I think we're going to definitely probably have to revisit that later on in the show. Sean, because Mrs. Rogers and I are both clinicians, we're both counselors, I'm wondering if we have a bias to how mental health issues are addressed, obviously because this is the field that we work in. For someone who is non-clinical, why would you say you believe there that society has a stigma attached to mental health issues?
Well, I mean, I think from a male perspective, it's considered a weakness. And I would like to echo, you know, what the good doctor said as well, is that traditionally from African-American culture, there wasn't access to someone who would have been a counselor, so they would have went to their priest, you know, or your elder in your family, and that was the structure that was created. So as we, you know, became a little bit more civilized, got the right to vote, you know, integrated schools, that was still something that, you know, was carried over, you know, in terms of that, you know, crazy uncle, you know, that they just kept in the basement or under the stairs, like, you know, you just kind of, like she said, that's just something that we didn't talk about because there wasn't, quote unquote, a solution for that. And then sometimes, you know, you did have some issues where, you know, somebody might have been, you know, molested and somebody might have been created as a product of that rape or incest. So, you know, it was just more like things that were done were kind of, like she said, kept within the family and dealt internally rather than, you know, leaning on society to fix the problems, because at that point, you know, no families really trusted society. You know, you didn't trust the police at that point because, you know, they were still lynching and hanging people. So you definitely weren't about to open up your family situation to an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I'm glad that you even mentioned the historical content, Sean, as it relates to the stigma attached to mental health. Because when you look at other minority groups or just other groups in general, even though there's an overall stigma attached to mental health issues in society, that's definitely a general concern, but it's more prevalent for African Americans. And so there has to be a reason why African Americans are so distrustful of the mental health services or that area versus maybe Asians or Hispanics or even individuals from the dominant culture. So when you mention historical content, Sean, is there other things that you believe historically also plays a part into why African Americans are so hesitant to seek out mental health services or even talk about it?
Well, I mean, like I said, I think it still goes back to just the mistrust of the structure that was in place. You know, even if we look at some of the recent issues with black males and police officers, you know, there's just a mistrust from the black community for that. And, you know, I had a friend, you know, send me a text the other day. It was kind of a joke, but it was true. It's like, you know, black people commit crimes wearing gangs. You know, white people commit crimes. They have mental health issues. You know, a Muslim commits crime and he's a terrorist. So, you know, there's nothing I think society fears besides, you know, a large, mentally unbalanced black man. So because we already have taken that in consideration, we're very reluctant to engage in those structures that would expose ourselves, our friends, and our family to, you know, be victimized by what we have come to mistrust in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so, because, again, we know that this is not one of those topics that everybody is talking about. For the most part, nobody wants to talk about this topic. Nobody wants to even admit, in many cases, that they have a mental health diagnosis. And so for our listeners tonight, if you guys have any questions, concerns, or just any general comments about the topic, we definitely want to hear from you. If you guys are streaming on the Internet, you can also chat with us a question or comment if you have one. And so if you do have a question, you can press 1. We'll acknowledge you, and definitely we want to hear your thoughts and comments about the issue that we're talking about tonight. So, Sean, I'm going to kind of bounce some different questions off of you because Mrs. Rogers and I are in the field. So for us, I don't believe that we view mental health the same way individuals that are not practicing in the field view it. For example, and Mrs. Rogers, you can speak to this, when you tell people that you're a therapist or you're a licensed professional counselor, what type of response do you get?
Ooh, are you shrinking me right now?
Right.
That's the first thing they want to know. And mm-hmm. They're like, ooh, I'm going to stop talking. And I'm like, wow, it's not that serious. And they do. They tend to take me a little differently
mm-hmm.
at first. And then afterwards, then they're like, want free advice.
Right. So people seem to think that if you are someone who works in the mental health field, that you're always analyzing people.
Always.
You're trying to shrink them, even though that term shrink hasn't been used in several years to describe therapists. Or mm-hmm. this is what I typically get when I tell people, oh, I'm a licensed professional counselor. The response is, you deal with crazy people. And so
yes.
I pause and I think, absolutely, I deal with everyday people. So if everyday people are crazy, then that's exactly who I deal with as a counselor. So, Sean, I want to ask you, when, you know, you hear somebody or you even encounter somebody that works in the mental health field, just what's your impression of them?
Oh, generally, I just go the other way. I'm just,
what?
Just be honest with you. Like, I have no need to interact with you. It's kind of like, you know, the police. The less we interact, the safer I feel. So, you know, which I think is kind of funny considering you all are professionals. And, you know, you and I have talked about this briefly. You know, I've taken several courses on body language and handwriting analysis. So I'm always analyzing everybody. You know, y'all mm-hmm. might not be, but I am.
Right.
You know, I want to see who's crazy. You know, what tendencies do you have? Are you selfish? Do you have problems with your family? Like, I'm looking for all of that all the time. That's just me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah, but my mother comes from a background of having a master's in psychology, so I got raised kind of funny. I'm mm-hmm. just always looking. That's just me. So,
now, when we talk about the whole idea behind mental health or psychological distress, I definitely want to make sure that I'm giving you guys some of those statistics that are out there. For example, adult blacks are 20% more likely to report serious psychological distress than whites. That's pretty interesting.
Uh-huh.
Also, adult blacks living below the poverty level are 3 times more likely to report psychological distress than those living above poverty. So we do know that socioeconomic status also correlates with psychological distress. And adult blacks are more likely to have feelings of sadness, hopelessness, and worthlessness than are adult whites. While blacks are least likely than whites to die from suicide attempts as teenagers, African-American teenage males have more suicide attempts. And that's 8.2% for African-American males versus the 6.3 attempts versus white males. So those are just a few of the statistics that look at the prevalence of mental health issues in the African-American community. So we know for a fact that it's occurring and that many individuals are suffering from it, but we also know is that the services are underutilized by African-Americans. And so even though we're in the helping profession, we're counselors, we're African-American, it's still difficult for us to get clients that look like us to even seek out services. And so I want you guys to address, what do you think are things that we can do as we talk about demystifying the stigma attached to mental health tonight? What do you think we can do to encourage African-Americans to seek out services that are available to them? And that's from
I think education. Well, from mm-hmm. the clinical standpoint and just, you know, me myself going through the experiences that I have and having to reach out to someone is being educated on it. And at first it was, and, you know, you can kind of take this as embarrassing at some point. And I think that was mentioned before is, you know, you kind of get embarrassed about saying that, oh, my gosh, I need help. And it's more so needing help because we do get into that point of our own pride gets in the way. And I think a friend of mine came to me and said, girl, it's no shame in going and talking to someone. And I think having that open door for me to walk through has made it a lot, you know, easier for me to see it from a different perspective. And I want to offer that to my clients as well. And so I think educating people on exactly what is counseling and what is therapy, what does that all entail? Mm-hmm. And in my own practice, I've, you know, tried to soften the blow. Life coaching, quite similar, similar. Mental health counseling, and trying to just kind of give alternative words where it's softening the blow, if you will, so that people won't think that, you know, psychotherapist, you know, then that takes people to a whole nother level. When you put psycho in front of anything, you're crazy.
Right. Exactly.
So, me, I think it's just softening the blow of, you know, asking for help, getting that life coaching, counseling. That's what I think.
Sean, what do you think? Again, you're non-clinical. What would you tell somebody, maybe a friend, a family member that you know is going through it? How would you encourage them to seek out mental health services?
Oh, no, me, I wouldn't. You know.
Okay.
You know, my family teeter-totters between genius and insanity, so that's just something we all know. So, you know, it's something we've all kind of dealt with. You know, they're going to be some time. You know, so, I think from a perspective of, you know, men, you know, you kind of get worried about your employability. So when you start talking about going to see a counselor, you know, then you are not sure how that might implicate yourself from your work standpoint. So a lot of times that might be something that you want to take in consideration. And I was listening to your stats earlier about the amount of people claiming mental health issues. I don't know if that's true or they're just trying to get that crazy check. You know, like, I don't know about that one. They might be trying to get another check. They might not really be crazy. You know, they might just be a little lazy.
Okay, Sean, I didn't use the term crazy. I used the term psychological distress.
Well, they might not be as distressed as they're leading on because they might want some government assistance. That is one of the hustles in some of the communities, so I've been told.
You know what? I work in this field. I've done the assessments.
Yes.
I don't doubt that it takes place. But I believe that 20% is actually underreported. Like, I know it's underreported. The numbers are definitely higher than that for African Americans that experience psychological distress. And I think that in our society, in our culture, I think we have been conditioned or raised to believe that things like stress and anxiety and depression, those are just things you live with as a person of color, more so than this is outside the norm. So I think those numbers are even higher than 20%. And, yeah, obviously you're always going to have people that will try to cheat the system. But I think when you talk about what's going to help people get services, and for you, Sean, you're saying, well, you wouldn't tell someone. Well, if you knew that somebody was really experiencing distress, and they're coming to you and they're asking you, what do you think I should do? And, you know, all this type of advice, and you're not clinical. And sometimes you can give good advice, but at the end of the day, we're talking about someone with a serious mental health disorder. Your goal isn't going to be say, oh, my goodness, I think you need to go get some help, some professional help.
No. You know, and I guess I'm part of the problem because, you know, as we had our show on the Angry Black Women Syndrome, you know, I do respect your field, but I'm tired of it always being a problem that needs to be diagnosed and helped. Sometimes people just need to be a little bit more accountable for the action. I understand sometimes there are mental health issues. There are things that have happened, but that's always been what's happened. You know, whether it's black people, white people, Jewish people, Indians, you know, it's about learning how to cope and be accountable. And, you know, I feel like in today's age, there's enough access to resources and tools online, public library. If you really got a problem, then you can find one. Like, I've had several of my friends talk to me about suicide, you know, but they were talking to me about it. Like, if they were trying to kill themselves, they would have been talking to me. So, you know, sometimes it's a plea for help. Sometimes it's just a plea for attention. So, I mean, that's just my perspective.
Right. But there's always, you know, that it goes back to kind of a genetic type of thing as well, that you will have some chemical imbalance where your logical thinking is not very logical. And so there are going to be times when you don't know why you have this impulsivity to go out and buy $1,700 shoes, and that's all you make in a month. So there's a point where you have to say, okay, there's something wrong, or either someone outside of that to say, hey, what's going on? Why did you do that? What was your logical thinking? And they just don't know. They have no clue that, oh, that's not illogical. And so sometimes,
well,
you know, you have to help out, open the door for them.
I mean, is it that, or is that how they've allowed themselves to be conditioned by propaganda in the media? Like, I mean, I think that there's a difference between, you know, like, say, for instance, I grew up with a guy who was mildly retarded. So we knew he was mildly retarded. He was pretty big, like 6'3", 230. And he did not like you touching his head. I don't know what it was about that, but you just knew not to touch Quinn's head. So I want to say within the past 5 years, one of the people that was taking care of him did something and touched his head, and he snapped a neck. Like, that's the difference between, you know, being mentally challenged.
But you're talking about cognitive functioning. So someone who is probably at a 70 below on the IQ. So that's a little bit different than we're talking about mental health. But wait, hold that thought, because we have a caller. So we're going to go to the phone lines and see if we have a question. 661, you're on the air.
Hey, guys, it's Joe Neckbone. Glad to hear you on the air still.
Hey, Joe Neckbone.
Hey, it's a great show. Hey, I just wanted to say to Sean, one thing you have to keep in mind, under current HIPAA laws, they cannot reveal anything about your mental condition or your state of health. It's against the law. So this is a good thing, but it's also a bad thing, because what you have is a lot of people in positions of power and or authority, like police. And if they have a mental issue, they don't have to reveal it to their employer. And so that mental issue can cause them to snap and go off. But again, under current HIPAA laws, you don't have to reveal it.
That is absolutely correct, Joe Neckbone. And for those of you that don't know, I also work at a managed healthcare, which is an insurance company. So I'm quite familiar with that policy. And on a day-to-day basis, I get phone calls from members who want to utilize the services, but they're so skeptical. They're paranoid because there's a concern that what if my supervisor finds out, or are you sure this doesn't get back to my employer? And so every day I'm reminding them about HIPAA guidelines, and that even though their supervisor may call, we can't even report that the employee even made the call to the insurance company. If those are some concerns that people have, and, again, I hear them on a day-to-day basis, then the option is you don't have to use your insurance company. And because most insurance companies have really high deductibles anyway, most people are paying out-of-pocket for their services. But an answer to that is there are a lot of community-based agencies that have sliding scales. So if that's a concern, you can go and pay out-of-pocket and utilize this sliding scale where there's anonymity. So nobody knows that you're utilizing those services.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a valid point. Thanks, Joe Neckbone.
It is.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to go back to, because, you know, Sean, you made the comment about the guy with the MR and, you know, how he acted out. How do you compare someone who is mildly retarded to someone with a mental health disorder? Because that's a learning disability.
Well, I mean, I think there's a difference in that scenario because of the cognitive functions. I do agree with the doctor that it may be some type of imbalance, whether it's a lack of lithium and maybe some toxic poisoning. Like, you can look at those things first, but, you know, I was a little thrown off because I knew not to touch Quentin in his head because I knew how Quentin would act. So I was a little surprised that his caregiver would do that. So that was just a mistake on her fault.
True.
So, you know, I think there is a difference, you know, in some regards when we're talking about mental health and when we talk about cognitive function. If, you know, it's difficult for me to kind of comprehend, you know, some of the.
Uh-oh. Sean, we lost you.
Right.
I was just saying that. Hello, I was just saying it's difficult for me to comprehend some of what you're saying because of my experiences. That's all.
Right, because they're definitely different. As we're talking about what are some potential barriers to treatment, both of you guys have mentioned some of them. And when they looked at some of the statistical data, apparently 40%, and we've kind of talked about this before, 40% of individuals with African Americans in particular with a psychological disorder are in denial. 40%, just plain denial. Like, that's not me. I don't have depression. I'm not anxious.
Right.
I don't have bipolar. They're in complete denial that they even have this mental health issue. And then one of you guys mentioned this. I think it was Sean. 38%, or maybe even you, Mrs. Rogers, 38% report embarrassment or shame as a result of reporting that they even have, that they're having some, experiencing some psychological distress. And then 31% are just saying, I don't even want the help. I just don't think I need it. So they're just refusing it altogether. And 29% report lack of money or insurance to pay for the services, which definitely we know it can be expensive to receive mental health services. And then 17% reported just being fearful about seeking out services. Another 17% reported lack of treatment or lack of knowledge about treatment and the problem. So another one of the reasons why we're doing the show tonight is because I think there's a lot of people that use terms and they're not quite sure about the terms that they use. So if I hear one more person tell me that they believe they sister, cousin, brother has bipolar because they're moody on Monday and moody on Thursday, I think I'm just going to scream. So tonight I definitely want us to look at the diagnosis of bipolar. And another big one is depression and anxiety and stress. And the reason why I say those three is because, again, I think African Americans in particular are more conditioned to living with stress. Like, I don't know anybody who just kind of has a stress-free life, but definitely we kind of accept that that's a part of our daily experience. Now, stress is one thing, but what I hear lots of my clients are talking about is they say that they're stressed out and overwhelmed, but the symptoms that they really do describe are the symptoms of depression. And when I ask them initially if they're depressed, the first thing that they say is no. And I think that that's just a lack of knowledge about what the symptoms of depression are. And so we're going to go over that, the symptoms for depression, bipolar, and Sean, again, non-clinical person, if someone comes to you, your friend, and they're telling you that, or you've even experienced them to be very moody sometimes, and then other times they're just elated with joy and they're in a really happy mood, would you think that that person had, like, some type of mental health disorder?
No, I'm real shallow, so I probably wouldn't be friends with them that long if they were like that, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I mean,
okay. So you just gonna cut them off? So let's say, Sean, these are some family members that present with these types of behaviors.
Oh, what?
These are family
members. You know about my relationship with my mother. My mother's depressed and somewhat bipolar, so, I mean, that's kind of our relationship, to be honest with you. And she's a hoarder, and, you know, she's depressed, but we've had those conversations, and she always tells me something is wrong with me, so until I can get power of attorney and get her committed, and we just kind of deal with it like it is.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
One of the things that you started off at the top of the show talking about was education and dispelling some of the myths about mental health is for us to educate people. So now we have an opportunity for all of our listeners that are listening to this show are going to tell people to go back and listen to the play of the show. What information can we give them about some specific diagnosis? And you're in private practice, so you are seeing the same diagnosis that I'm seeing that are more frequent, in particular in African-American communities. And so is there one in particular that you would like for us to address?
Well, definitely I agree with you about the stress, and then that breeds into your anxiety. And definitely, you know, we can live with levels of stress, but then it starts to increase. And then you end up with depression, you know, just like you had mentioned. And the bipolar, like I alluded to about the lady that would, you know, go buy a $1,700 pair of shoes, and that's what her monthly mortgage is, that's when you're getting to a dangerous zone. And that's that bipolar that starts to present. And it doesn't always present when they're in their 30s. And mostly it's more predominant, like, as they're coming out of teens, you know, into the 18 to 20-year-old range, if I'm not mistaken. But then that's when you see all these spirals of depression, which is, you know, more commonly you're going to see a lot of the depression. And then only once, maybe every 6 months, you'd see this spike of aggression or, you know, partying for a month. And, you know, that's when the balance comes in. But definitely that anxiety and stress is what I see a lot of. And then there are people that end up having to, you know, leave their jobs. That's very real. You know, they can't pull into the parking lot. You know, so I think it serves people well to just know the symptoms. And basically when you start, you know, having palpitations of the heart, start feeling like a heart attack, we need to check that out. You know, mental health and physical. If I have clients that come in and they're like, oh, my chest, I have heavy breathing, my heart sounds like it's beating in my head, I'll recommend them, even though I'm kind of sensing where this is going, I'll recommend, yeah, you might need to go see your doctor, your PCP, so you can make sure that your physical body is okay. And most of the time they'll come back and say, yeah, my doctor said, he said that I have anxiety. Well, yeah, because there's nothing really wrong with your heart, but you haven't figured out how to disseminate your anxiety and the stressors there, you know, that are coming with it. So basically just, you know, taking note of what's going on with your body is kind of, you know, where it leads me to prevent you from going down that road of anxiety and depression.
So for you in practice, the ones that you see quite frequently is the anxiety, the depression, the bipolar. Those would be the ones that you said. Okay. And so as you talked about bipolar, and again, I back in the 90s, even early 2000, it seemed that every child under the age of 18 was diagnosed with ADHD. So any child that was having difficulty in school, they were ADHD, and more frequently, African-American males were diagnosed with ADHD. And so it seems like every 10 years or so, there's a shift in diagnosis. And back then it was ADHD. Now we're definitely seeing more of a shift to many individuals are being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And then also we're seeing a more prevalence amount of individuals diagnosed with autism. And so when we talk about bipolar, you know, there's bipolar 1, there's bipolar 2. And so bipolar, for what some people, I don't know if they know, it's a spectrum disorder. And so in order to have it, it presents with at least one manic episode or a mixed episode. And in those episodes, it's hypomania, which is what Mrs. Rogers talks about, where the individual is completely impulsive, maxing out credit cards, marrying someone they just met a week ago. Anything that you can imagine is, I guess, the most impulsive thing that someone you know could do, that's the hypomania. It's going for days without sleep but not feeling sluggish and tired. It's having a burst of energy all of a sudden. And those periods are short-term. So it may be 3 or 4 days, it may be a week, but it's not a long-term time for the mania. And then what's followed by it, which is the depression. And that's what most people have difficulty with, because now they're falling into this deep depression, whereas a week prior to that, they were on top of the world, things were peachy cream, they loved everyone, they were super excited and motivated, and now they can barely get out of their bed, they have feelings of hopelessness, helplessness, they're isolating themselves, their eating habits have decreased. And so when people are talking about individuals who they believe are bipolar, it's not just the occasional mood swings that everyone has, but it's these extreme from the hypomania to the depression. And so those are some things to look for. So if you, you know, have individuals in your life that you think are making extreme impulsive decisions, maybe that's a red flag, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they have bipolar. They may just be poor decision makers.
Yes, correct. Definitely.
Which we all know some. I definitely want to make sure that we talk about depression and some symptoms of depression, because all too often I have clients that for some reason it's difficult for them to even say they're depressed, and even after I give them a depression scale, it's difficult to own that, oh my goodness, I'm depressed. Like sometimes they'll look at their score and say, I can't believe my score was that high. I thought it was going to be a whole lot lower. I just thought I was stressed. And so I want to make sure we cover this criteria, because if you're this individual or you know someone, it may be time for you to go seek out professional help. So when you talk about the symptoms of depression, some of the things that you're looking for, obviously, is a depressed mood most of the day. And that could present with feelings of sadness, just feeling empty. It even comes with feelings of hopelessness. I'm not sure how I'm going to get out of this, helplessness. I don't think that there's anybody that can help me. It's always going to be this way. Many individuals report a lack of interest in things they used to do, but now they're just not motivated to do it, and that could be spending time with family, a hobby. It could even be going to work. Other symptoms of depression is significant weight loss, and that could be overeating or undereating. And sometimes there's a mix. It just depends. Changes in sleeping patterns, so either insomnia or hyposomnia. Some people will sleep the entire day and wake up 3 or 4 hours only to fall right back to sleep, whereas other individuals cannot sleep at all. And so they're taking sleep aids, you know, in order for them to sleep. They find themselves taking a glass of wine a night just to fall asleep. So you're looking at disturbed sleeping patterns. Increased agitation, and so this is where the individual feels really restless, fidgets a lot, just a lot of moving around and agitation. Other symptoms are fatigue, loss of energy the entire day, just this, it's so difficult for me to get out of bed, it's so difficult for me to just do anything, especially do the things that I used to do. I kind of mentioned the feelings of hopelessness, helplessness, feelings of worthlessness, difficulty concentrating, and then definitely one of the bigger ones that we're looking at when we're making diagnosis for major depression is that the individual has had thoughts of death or has a preoccupation with death and dying. So of those symptoms that I just mentioned to you, an individual has to have at least 5 or more of those, and they have to be present for at least a 2-week period consistently. So if you know anybody, or even if this is you, I just mentioned those, the symptomologies of depression, and it's been present, ongoing, for at least 2 weeks, and it's at least 5 or more, that's definitely a red flag that maybe you want to seek out professional help to address some of those issues. Mrs. Rogers, anything else you want to say about the depression or the anxiety?
Well, I want to definitely piggyback on what you said. You had mentioned an assessment tool that you use to, you know, give to your clients, and I use one as well. And it's very important to know that if you're feeling this, it's very important to get that type of assessment. You know, you can't argue with the data. That's my biggest thing is, you know, the numbers on the paper, I didn't think my numbers would be that high. They don't lie. And it's very helpful when you are, you know, giving a diagnosis. So many times we do get these random diagnoses, like you said, oh, yeah, that bipolar. Well, how do you know that? And I always like to corroborate that. Well, we took an assessment, and it shows that, you know, your rating scale is here. You know, this is, you know, very high. It's in a very high range where you need to get some work. So I really impress upon anybody, if somebody's just going to, you know, throw a diagnosis at you without getting any data, then, you know, you might need to question that diagnosis. But I know that Dr. Guy and myself, we both use assessment tools to kind of figure out where you are so we know where to start.
Exactly. And, Sean, one of the things that you mentioned earlier about one of the stigmas attached to why people don't go, obviously we kind of mentioned the shame, but I'm going to go back to for men. For men, is there a difference about how it's perceived if you believe they go see therapists or counselors versus if a African-American woman seeks out counseling?
I mean, definitely, because it's not something tangible that you can put your hand on. Like, you know, men, we like to be able to measure and see. But when you start getting into the unknown, you know, there's something that we can't really quantify or understand, so we tend to stay away from it. So I think, like I said, it really goes back to, you know, we just talk about slave culture. Like every problem you had with a slave, you just would beat it out of him. Like, oh, he acting crazy, we'll just beat him. You know, she acting hoish, we'll beat the hoe out of her. Like, you know, so that was our, you know, tool that we used for all our problems. And as we've gotten older, you know, we don't have that same tool, so we just ignore it like it's going to go away.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Hmm. And you know what? It's funny that you say ignore it like it's going to go away, because I do believe that in many of our minds, we kind of feel like this issue or this psychological distress that I'm experiencing, I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm not going to change my lifestyle. I'm not going to develop some coping skills. I'm just going to continue to function the way I'm going, but it's eventually going to go away. Like if, you know, I just keep on living life, it's going to go away. And the, I guess, the downside of just waiting for it to go away is that in some cases it does. It's the occasional blues and people get better and they continue to function and move on with their life. But when we're talking about true mental health issues, those don't go away because you're talking about chemical imbalances. And so the chemical just doesn't balance itself out without some type of assistance. So in those particular cases, people don't get better, they get worse. And not only does their psychological distress get worse, but now they have physical symptoms that create problems. And so what we know in our field is that most people, I'm not going to say all, but most people will not go into counseling until they've had physical symptoms. Like they've been going to see their primary care physician and they've had severe headaches, like all of a sudden they're having migraines that don't go away. Or they've had upset stomach, nausea, just major stomach pains that don't go away, and all of their medications are not helping. Or they've had disturbed sleeping patterns for months and months, and everything that they're taking, you know, doesn't help. Like, those are the cases where I think individuals are just hoping and wishing these symptoms go away, and instead they have manifested into something that's physical. And by this point, it's kind of the body's way of saying, look, I'm really tired of you ignoring this. You need to do something about it, or I'm literally about to shut you down. Mm-hmm. So that ignoring process really doesn't help in all cases.
I agree completely.
From my experience, you know, like I said, my mother is depressed. I know she's depressed, but, you know, she is so smart that she tells me that she's not. So it's, no, that's not what's wrong. Oh, I wouldn't know what was wrong with me if I was depressed. So, you know, I can tell you some of the things she does, and it doesn't take a gypsy to kiss the ball to know she's depressed. You know, like, you know, she hoards things. You know, she sleeps in a chair in front of the TV in a fetal position, you know. You know, so there are a lot of things that she does that I'd be like, hey, well, you know, normal people don't do that. And she's like, well, that's just what I do, and I don't need any help because I'm smart. So, you know, I'm not sure if that's a category of people that are too smart to get diagnosed, but, you know, that's kind of what I'm dealing with.
Sounds like denial.
Exactly. It sounds like denial. And after practicing in the field for going on 15 years now, what I do know about mental health issues or disorders is that they don't discriminate. Like, they don't decide that I'm going to pick on African-Americans, Hispanics, I'm going to pick on people with a 70 below IQ. Like, it doesn't discriminate. So I don't care how intelligent you are, what your IQ is, mental health issues are just mental health issues. And so, you know, if you're the smartest person, you can still be depressed, and your symptoms are still going to reflect that. So I'm not sure what she does about that.
No, I always tell her that, you know, if she had more money, she would be eccentric, but since she doesn't, she's crazy. You got to be rich to be eccentric. When you're poor, you're just crazy. So.
Let it be known that the two clinicians on the show did not say that. Sean
DeRillis
said that he believes.
Who was it, Charles Lindbergh, that had somebody put a cheeseburger outside his door every day? Like, if you can afford that, then that's eccentric. If you're doing like the nice doctor said and you're spending your $1,700 on your mortgage on shoes and you can't afford it, that's crazy.
Well, okay, since you're talking about your mother and maybe some psychological issues that she may have, we do not know. Let's talk about genetics. Because as we talk about mental health issues and how there is a correlation between socioeconomic status, your current living environment, but that's not the only thing. So there's also individuals have a genetic predisposition to have some diagnosis. And I think that's the other thing that family members don't talk about. That's, you know, we're going to sweep it in the closet. You know, cousin Bobby, he used to hear voices, but, you know, that was just that alcohol. No, that wasn't that alcohol. Cousin Bobby was probably a schizophrenic. There's some genetic predisposition in the family to have some mental health issues. And so I think that that's definitely important for us to talk about, to touch on tonight, just about for people to kind of know that information. Mrs. Rogers, how important do you think that is when we talk about genetics and treatment?
Well, when we do psychosocial assessments, you know, in the very initial session, that is very important. We ask that, you know, has there been any mental health issues diagnosed in your family? And most of the minorities, when I asked them that, they were like, well, there was one time, you know, that we had to do this and such and so and so. But, you know, basically, we just think it was the alcohol, you know, or he used a lot of drugs, you know, or post-traumatic stress. And, you know, it perplexes me because we'll take post-traumatic stress with someone that has been in the military. You know, we're okay with that. But, you know, when it's just you just going through life, we can't accept that, you know, in a family. And they just deny that there's anything else. But it does play a big role in how we treat it. You know, if we're going to treat ourselves with, oh, if I just have two glasses of wine before I go to bed, then I'm fine. But then also we find out that there has been a history of alcoholism in the family. What was it masking? You know, you're taking on that role. So, yes, it's very important.
And I think you just kind of opened up another can of worms that we, you know, didn't even talk about. But the correlation between substance abuse and mental health issues. So what we do know is that many individuals will self-medicate. And they won't even realize that they're self-medicating. And so a big one that is utilized to self-medicate is marijuana and alcohol. Like, those are definitely two of the more primary substances that are utilized. We do know that people who smoke marijuana will say they smoke for multiple reasons. It calms them down. You know, they don't feel nervous. They feel calm. Like, all of the things that they're talking about are alleviating some type of psychological distress symptoms that could be possibly treated with talk therapy or even with prescribed medication, but they're choosing to self-medicate. And also the same thing with alcohol. Many individuals will utilize alcohol to self-medicate. And what always seems to amaze me when it comes to alcohol is that people who typically are reporting depressive symptoms, but they're drinking daily, I'm not sure they realize that alcohol is a true depressant.
Right.
So for the person who's depressed and continues to drink, well, alcohol really doesn't help your depression. It actually makes it worse. So, again, when we talk about kind of the stigma attached to it, I think people are more accepting of a substance abuse problem than they are saying, I have depression, I have bipolar, or, you know, this individual has schizophrenia. And to me, there's a problem with that, that we're not open enough to own what our true diagnosis is to get the real help versus to go ahead and self-medicate and own that diagnosis or own that problem. So I'm glad that you brought that one up. The other one that you definitely mentioned is post-traumatic stress disorder. So post-traumatic stress disorder masks itself in so many ways. And, again, we talk about PTSD when we're looking at the military population, but there are everyday individuals that are living with PTSD. And it's from numerous things, from early childhood trauma to domestic violence to current bad relationships. And it's so amazing how people have these symptoms, again, and yet they go undiagnosed or they're masked by something else, but their true symptomology lies in PTSD. And Sean, I'm really afraid to ask you this question because I never know where you going to go with your response. So I'm just going to go ahead and ask you anyway. So as we talked about, you know, genetics, and you said mom, you clearly know that mom has depression, and we're saying that typically it's genetic and it runs in the family. What does that mean about you, Sean?
Well, two things. Either I need to get enough money so I can be eccentric and not crazy, or it's something that's solely her and her environment that she has chosen, which primarily is what it is. So originally from my family, I grew up around a lot of older people, and everybody pretty much has died but her and I. So I deal with death relatively well, but she's never really grieved. So that's part of what the hoarding is she has my grandmother's items. She has my grand aunt's items. She has my grand uncle's items. She has my aunt's items in the house because she's never grieved and let go. So that's primarily why she's depressed. You know, me on the other hand, not so much. So, you know, that's more of a conditional thing and not really genetic.
For her. Oh, okay. So, Mr. Rogers, he said,
I'm predisposed for.
At the end of the day, I would say that it is safe to, and this is just my belief, I believe that every single individual, I just don't care who you are, has a predisposition for something. And it may be alcoholism, maybe some type of substance abuse. It may be some type of mental health disorder. It may be something medical, diabetes, high blood pressure, all those things. We all have a predisposition for it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be mom, dad, immediate family, cousin, or, you know, auntie, uncle. It could be my second, third cousin. It's still in the bloodline. And so I think one of the things that, as Mrs. Rogers talked about, is education. We really have to go back to teaching people how to be able to deal with crisis and turmoil when they're experiencing it. Because if you have a predisposition for something, whatever it is, as it relates to mental health issues, as I do believe we all have, it's kind of like the light switch that's turned off. And you go through your everyday experiences with the light switch off. And then all of a sudden, a traumatic experience takes place, or something that you interpret as a traumatic experience. You have the opportunity at that point to either deal with that traumatic experience in a healthy way, which I believe looks like seeking professional help, or if you are a faith-based person, utilizing that. But something has to happen, and not for you to believe that if I ignore it and act like it didn't happen, it will go away. When that occurs, it's like flipping the light switch on. So it activates that mental health issue that was already lying dormant, that's already been present. And so once that light switch is turned on, it's on for life. Like, it does not go off. When people talk about bipolar diagnosis and schizophrenia or even clinical depression, people want a cure. And what we know is that there is no cure, but there is treatment, and it's manageable. So now the light switch has been activated. That dormant gene is now active. You have to learn how to live with it. And live with it doesn't mean denying it or repressing it or suppressing it. It means managing it and getting help. And getting help comes in so many shapes, forms, or fashion. I don't think that we can stress the importance of that. And that's because we come into contact with so many people who are living with psychological distress on a day-to-day basis, and yet they're ignoring it, or they're praying that it's going to go away, but they're not doing anything about it. And what we know about prayer without works is, or
dead.
Faith without works is dead. So
yes,
individuals have to be moved or motivated to actually do something about that. And so the great part about that is that there's treatment. Like, we haven't even talked about treatment.
Right. And people,
so,
you know what, and I think that's another stigma, Dr. Guy, is
mm-hmm.
that they don't think it's treatable. Because if you're crazy, you know, as in their terms of people that are not aware, they don't think that they can you can live productively with, you know, being depressed and
mm-hmm.
having bipolar. That's the thing that I think that might be one of the stigmas. They think that they cannot live normally.
True. And they can. We're not saying that it's easy and that it's not a day-to-day challenge. I really wish that as a society we would embrace alcohol, we would embrace mental health issues the way we embrace alcoholism.
Uh-huh.
And what I mean by that is that people – and not always, but a lot of people will be more willing and accepting of saying, I drink, and I'm okay with my drinking, even though it's in excess. I drink to manage my problems. Once they go into treatment, let's say they do a seven, they go into treatment and they realize that every single day I live being I live a sober life. So I don't focus on, oh, my goodness, I have to be sober for the next 30 days. My focus on, I have to stay sober for today. And then tomorrow, I'll stay sober for tomorrow. I think if we looked at mental health issues in the same way, that people may be more willing to manage it and to actually get the treatment, because it is a day-to-day experience. For the person who is has truly been diagnosed with bipolar, it's manageable with the right medication. And key word is the right medication.
That's
and not
right.
All medications are going to fit for every individual. And, yes, they have side effects. So the trade-off is to figure out which side effects you're willing to deal with. But the drawback with individuals with bipolar or individuals with schizophrenia or depression is that when they start taking the medication and they get better, what do?
They go off their
medication. They go off their medication, exactly. Uh-huh. So they get better for a while, and life gets good, and they enjoy it, and then something else happens, which may just be a major stressor in their life, and because they're off of their medication, it takes them right back to where they were before they started taking it. And so now they begin to cycle, and so they get on meds, get better, get off meds, get on meds, get better. And so when we talk about treatment modalities, I definitely want to stress that medication is an option. Christy and I both believe in skills over pills,
yes,
which
ma'am.
We encourage people to go do the work first, and that's in talk therapy. But sometimes you need medication. We're not against that. It's the combination of both that helps people manage it a little bit better. But we definitely want to make sure that people are getting some type of treatment. And also acknowledge that it's okay. Like, saying that you're depressed or anxious isn't a sign of weakness. It's a sign of just being human. So anybody who perceives it as a weakness, I think that's the problem. And, again, that ties into our stigma. And so we do want to let individuals know that everyone experiences some of those symptoms. And they're appropriate, actually. If you lose a loved one and you're going through the five stages of grief at some point, you will probably feel depressed and anxious and all of those other things. And so those are not negative things. Those are not signs of weakness, but that's part of the process for healing to go through the grieving steps. So I definitely want to make sure that if you guys are listening to the show, and we definitely have a lot of listeners tuning in tonight, that if you know someone who is experiencing any of these mental health concerns that we address, encourage them to go talk to somebody. They don't have to talk to them for years. They can go to one or two sessions, and sometimes that's just enough to kind of get them back on track and to help. So, Sean, I know you have some closing remarks, but I'm not going to come to you yet. I am going to go to Mrs. Rogers. What would you like our listeners to know as we wrap up What is Real Crazy, Part 2?
Well, I just think education is the key. Definitely go out there. If you're feeling like you're in distress and you feel that something's just not right, sometimes you just need to talk it through. And it doesn't have to be forever. Like you stressed, it doesn't have to be forever. It's just getting a different viewpoint. Sometimes we're too much wrapped up in our emotions or things going on that we can't see the forest for the trees. So it's always helpful to get another opinion. And I definitely encourage you to do that.
And Mrs. Rogers, for those people that are tuning in, how, if somebody wanted to contact you or if somebody is in the DFW area, because that is where you practice, how would they be able to reach you?
Well, I have a website. It's bridgestocrossroadscounseling.com. And you can find me on the Internet. And it's Bridges to Crossroads Counseling. Or you can just look me up on Google me, Christia Rogers.
And just an Amos plug before I go to Sean to wrap up is stay tuned because June 20th, Mrs. Rogers and I are doing a couples retreat called Round Holes and Square Pegs in Irving. Is it in Irving?
In Irving.
So more information about that coming. But, Sean, you got any closing remarks for us tonight on What is Real Crazy?
Yeah, I know we touched real briefly on me and some of my psychosis, you know, and I'm here to tell anybody you know, you can get over strippers. It's hard, but you can. Like, you know, once you put your mind to it, and it don't go. It's like you said, it's like alcoholism. You got to take it one day at a time. And one day it turns into a week, and it turns into a month, and you don't have to go see Coco no more. So if I did it.
Yes, indeed. As always, Sean, I never know what to say. But as always, you guys, thank you so much for tuning in for tonight's show. Make sure you tune in next week. Tell a friend. Pass it on. Don't forget to Facebook and tweet it. Dr. Guys, Monday Night Gumbo. Everyone have a safe and blessed week. Bye, Sean. See you, Ms. Rogers.
Bye-bye. Thanks for the invite.
You got to come back. Thanks.
Okay.